session pursuant to law.
Thank you. Please be seated, everyone. Appreciate your indulgence as we make our way through these cases today and up to our last case for our Pocatello visit today in a case entitled Hickman versus Boomers, LLC, number 50543. The case is brought on behalf of Emma and Samuel Hickman as appellants with Jedediah Bigelow as counsel speaking to us today, with Stephen K. Brown appearing only. Also, the respondents are Boomers, LLC, Boomers Crane and Transport, Inc., Coulter Johnson and Michael Landon, represented here by David P. Gardner. Counsel, either of you have any preliminary issues for this court before argument today?
Your Honor, just briefly, Boomers Crane and Trucking was stipulated to be dismissed from this case that they were not involved in it. And so just clarification for the court's sake, they are not part of the respondents today.
I believe I remember that now. Okay, thank you. With that, Mr. Bigelow, you may proceed.
Good morning, and thank you, Chief Justice Bevin and Justices. May it please the Court. My name is Jedediah Bigelow, and I represent Samuel and Emma Hickman in this case. We're here today to seek the reversal of the District Court's decisions, which grant summary judgment in favor of the respondents and deny the appellant's motion for reconsideration. On April 29th, 2019, Mr. Hickman was electrocuted and sustained severe injuries when a crane operated by the respondents came into contact with overhead high-voltage power lines. This is not a mere negligence case or even a gross negligence case. This is an extreme recklessness case. Coulter Johnson, the crane operator on that day, had actual knowledge of the obvious and grave risk in working around power lines with the crane and consciously disregarded every safety precaution that he was trained on. Ultimately, the lower court's decision misapplied legal standards as set by this court in Gomez v. Kirkham and failed to view the disputed facts in the most favorable light to my clients as the non-moving party in summary judgment. Our appeal is grounded on two key points. First is the misapplication of legal standards. Mr. Hickman was injured in 2019. The Idaho State Legislature amended Idaho Code Section 72209 in 2020. Despite this, the district court erroneously applied the standard contained in the 2020 amendment retroactively to this case when it should not have. Instead, the court should have applied the standard set forth in Gomez, which requires consideration of whether the defendants actually knew or had consciously disregarded knowledge of an obvious and grave risk of injury. The incorrect application of law fundamentally undermined the court's ruling. Second key point is the existence of genuine issues of material fact. The record shows numerous genuine issues of material fact that preclude summary judgment. For example, there's conflicting testimony about whether a safety meeting was held, a spotter was designated, a safety plan was formed at all, and the required distances that the crane had to be kept from the overhead power lines. Mr. Johnson's admission that he's a certified crane operator with training specifically due to the dangers of working around the overhead power lines, that he knew about the power lines and the obvious and grave risk that they entailed, and that he felt the fall of any and that he failed to follow any established safety protocols demonstrates a conscious disregard for the serious risk of Mr. Hickman getting injured. The crux of our argument is that the defendants have both actual knowledge and their actual knowledge of the extreme hazard posed by operating the crane of the high voltage power lines and consciously disregarded all of the necessary safety measures required to mitigate that risk. This court's precedence in Gomez clearly supports the application of the consciously disregarded standards to the facts as presented by the Hickmans. We respectfully are going to request this court to reverse the district court's decision, remand the case for further proceedings, and ensure that the correct legal standards are applied to allow the facts to be fully examined by the fact finder of the jury. So to get more into detail on my arguments, I'm going to begin with our first key point, which is the misapplication of legal standards. As this case is well aware, the prodigy of Barrett v. Hecla, Merrick v. Hecla, were both decided in 2016. In Barrett, what the court ruled was that the plaintiff must show that the defendant intended to harm the plaintiff, or that the defendant had actual knowledge that the injury would occur. In that case, as the court decided, Hecla was aware of a rock burst that had occurred. They hired expert engineers to come in and assess that rock burst. They implemented a two-phase plan, the first phase being done And they were waiting to implement the second phase when they had employees down there and the second rock first occurred. In that case, this court stated that because they had a plan, but that they didn't necessarily implement it in the right way, they didn't there was no discussion of consciously disregard. They were well aware of the risk. They took steps to try to prevent that. Mary, which was decided the exact same day in 2016, had also involving mining company, had very similar fact patterns, but one difference was that in this case, the defendants came forward and said, we had no idea that there was a risk. And that's where the court for the first time brings up the phrase consciously disregarded knowledge. Fast forward to 2020 with Gomez v. Crookham. The court realized in that ruling, or in that case, that the application of the consciously disregarded knowledge standard had not clearly been spelled out, and putting it into practice was a bit difficult. And so in the Gomez case, the court held that a plaintiff must show that there is genuine issue of material fact that the defendant consciously disregarded knowledge of a grave and serious risk to the plaintiff. The key distinction there is where Merrick and Barrett were focused on knowledge or disregarding that an injury would occur. Gomez is focused on consciously disregarded knowledge of the serious risk. In this case, respondents
are arguing. Hold on just a second. You used the word risk. Use the language in actually in Gomez. Isn't it grave? It's not risk. It's grave and something else. Another buzzword.
That's a good question, Justin Brody. So there's actually several different terms used. At the very end of the case, it is a serious risk. Earlier on in the case, it's an obvious and grave risk. I do believe that risk is used throughout the opinion, though.
Okay. And risk of what?
Risk of injury.
That it will result, that it might result, that it could result. It seems like the language has also been pretty stark, and that your knowledge is this is going to harm him. There's not a question about it.
Right, and I would agree that under Barrett and Merrick that was the standard. But with Gomez, I believe it was expanded to not just belief or knowledge that it could occur, but it's the lack of appreciation for the severe risk presented in whatever the task is at hand. And like I said, the decision uses several different terms, obvious and grave being one of them, severe being another. Respondents have argued that Gomez doesn't apply because in 2020 the legislature has amended Idaho Code 72209, and that it should be retroactively applied. In Judge Dwight's decision, he characterized it in the order regarding the motion for reconsideration, he characterized it not as an amendment, but as a process to clarify the statute. Under the legislative process, when there is an existing statute, the legislature has two options. They can either amend a statute or they can repeal. There is no formal process for clarifying. Respondents have used the term conversation, having a conversation with the judicial branch. Again, there is no legal process for having a quote-unquote conversation with the judicial branch. It is either an amendment or it's not. In this case, it is an amendment. And the standard is, as well briefed in our briefing, is that amendments are not typically viewed retroactively unless they explicitly say so. And in this case, that didn't happen. In fact, it's actually even further. The Workman's Compact itself says that it is not retroactive. So the proper standard in this case should be Gomez, and the facts of this matter should be viewed under that standard of consciously disregard knowledge of an obvious grave or serious risk to the plaintiff. As far as the factual disputes in this case go, there is a litany of material facts that are issued. The court in the lower decision construed the record in favor of the respondents, accepted some of their allegations as the facts and the truth, and ignored the fact that all of the alleged facts have to be favored, like most favorable to the non-moving party, in this case, my clients. A list of those facts include the following. First, Walter Johnson states that he had discussed a detailed plan with Richard King, and that he first offered to help gambling with the trust. Richard King stated that he was the one who asked Johnson to help move the trust without the crane, and Johnson refused twice, stating he could move it with the crane. Next is the safety meeting. The American Society of Mechanical Engineers standards require that a safety meeting be held with all persons on the job site who could be affected by the overhead power lines. Johnson stated that he held a safety plan meeting with all the parties that morning. Every other witness and party that day says that never happened. The existence of a plan. The district court claimed that there was a plan to move the truss from under the power lines, albeit it was poorly implemented. Plaintiffs argued that there was no plan. There was definitely no plan that was ever conveyed to Sam Hickman, my client, but that there was no plan and no safety plan. Even if Johnson's version of a plan is true, and a court or a fact finder were to find that, this is not a case of poor implementation of that plan, as it would be in Barrett. This is a case where no plan was implemented at all. Mr. Johnson says he had a plan, and then he didn't follow anything that he says the plan was. There was no implementation at all. The next fact that is in dispute is the appointment of a spotter. Respondents argue that Mr. Johnson designated Richard King as a spotter for the crane. Richard King says that that never happened, and the other witnesses also testified, said in deposition that Johnson never designated a spotter. Minimum clearance of the distance. Again, the ASME standards require that a crane operator contact the power company. This is actually also required by Iowa Code 552401. Through that contact, you're supposed to be able to learn what the voltage of the power line is, which then determines how far away they need to stay away. That never happened. There was no contact with the power company that day or prior to the injury occurring. complete depositions. At the time of the motion for summary judgment, transcripts or partial transcripts of the depositions were submitted to the court. And the motion to reconsider, complete depositions were given to the court. A review of the deposition of Holter Johnson shows that he makes numerous statements contrary to the statements of all other parties involved, including such things as no CPR was performed or that he immediately left the truck to check on my client, Sam. All other witnesses say that never happened. The reason that this is important is because with all of these differences in facts, that is one way that the jury could find that Holter Johnson's testimony is not credible. Significance of the safety standards. The district court stated that the Hickmans were asking the court to find that unless Johnson had followed every ASME standard, he consciously disregarded the risk. That's not the position that we're arguing, nor that we have argued. The position of the Hickmans is not that Jensen and Johnson had not followed all of the standards, it's that he didn't follow any of them, not a single one. A complete disregard of his training is tantamount to consciously disregarding the severe risk of working around power lines. Lastly, Johnson's testimony covered close the crane came to the power lines. In his deposition, Johnson was shown a picture after the incident taken by Madison County Sheriff's Office. Johnson denied that he was that close to the power lines despite looking at the picture. Richard King's testimony was that the crane was only inches away from the power line when he came back around the corner. Johnson also testified that after the incident that he felt like the crane was sucked into the power lines like a magnet. All of these facts that are either in dispute or uncontested need to be viewed in the favor of my clients as the non-moving party, and the court failed to do that. With these facts, if taken as true, as they should be presented by the non-moving party, clearly rise to the level of a conscious disregard of the severe risk. Again, this is not a case where a plan was partially implemented. This is not a case where the respondents didn't know of the risk. The ASME clearly put them on notice of the grave risk that is being dealt here, gave them safety standards that they needed to comply with, and he didn't do any of it, not a single one. unless the court has any questions for me, I have one comment in closing before I reserve the remainder of my time for my rebuttal. But going back to the analogy of film as the shark tank. In this case, the power lines are the tank, the electricity are the sharks. And when Holter Johnson threw the cable to Sam Hickman and said, "We're ready to go," he essentially threw him into the shark tank. Now, the main difference between that analogy and what happened in this case is if you send an employee into a shark tank, there's still a question about whether the sharks are going to attack. When it comes to high voltage power lines, there is no question that when you touch a high voltage power line, you will get electrocuted. And so for those reasons, we believe that Gomez does apply and that the court should remand this for further review.
Thank you. Mr. Carter.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the court. My name is Dave Gardner. I represent Boomers LLC and Mr. Johnson in this case. And I have to just say it's a bit surreal being in this courtroom. Nearly 30 years ago, when I was clerking, I was the first law clerk for Randy Smith, and his chambers were just down the hall. This was Judge Woodland's courtroom at that time. And we're up right up to the noon hour. I used to come over and eat my lunch in that jury room right there. I feel like I'm going to get my lunch from that jury room today, from all of you, with some of the things that I have to say. So with that preface, we respectfully request that this court affirm the decisions that were entered by Judge Michael White on both the motion for summary judgment as well as the motion for reconsideration. We submit that he correctly applied the proper standard in determining that the willful or unprovoked physical aggression exception to the workers' compensation exclusivity doctrine was properly applied to the facts of this case. Respectfully, I would submit that the Gomez decision created a different standard than what was previously applied by the courts, and that standard has now been superseded by legislative statute. By my count, that standard lasted for approximately 4 months, from February of 2020 until June of 2020. I would submit that the Gomez standard should not be applied anymore by this court nor any court in this state. As a workers' compensation practitioner for 25 years, it would be very important for this court to draw a distinctive battle line between fault-based, reckless, tort conduct and sure relief through the workers' compensation system. I would submit that that would be important in order to keep those worlds from colliding any further. In the last few years, there have been many collisions. In fact, I have currently three cases pending with this court that raise this very issue.
So, Mr. Gardner, are you advocating for doing away with the willful or unprovoked physical aggression standard that's in the statute?
No, not at all. I would just submit that the interpretation that Gomez made of that statute went beyond what the case law indicated for years. I think it is clear now that Gomez is no longer the standard. The 2020 amendment is the standard. With that in mind, I think it will be important for this court to recognize that and rectify that situation.
So why don't you jump to, if you don't mind my asking, to the appellant's argument that because this incident happened in 2019, the Gomez standard does apply. In other words, that the amendment that went into effect on July 1st, 2020, is not retroactive.
And I would agree that the amendment is not retroactive, but I would submit that this court's decision in Gomez, which again was entered in February of 2020, is also not retroactive. Mr. Hickman's accident occurred in April of 2019, before this court had decided Gomez. And to now use Gomez to go back and say that that was the standard that applied back in April of 2019, I would submit that is also a problem.
That's not the way case law works, though. Would you concede that?
I would concede that. But Judge White was looking at this case not in a vacuum. He was looking at this case knowing what the legislature had done and what courts had previously done. There is a distinctive difference between the standard that was set forth in Merrick and the standard that is set forth in Gomez. The Merrick standard was consciously disregarded knowledge that injury would occur. The standard in Gomez is, I want to make sure I get it right, consciously disregarded knowledge of a serious risk. That is a very different standard than knowledge that injury would occur.
So if you were to go with the Merrick standard, does your client still prevail?
Yes, Your Honor. I would submit that my client prevails.
How so?
Because there is no evidence that Coulter Johnson consciously disregarded knowledge that this injury would occur.
So Mr. Bigelow just likened the situation to the Shark Tank in Gomez and pointed out that when someone comes into contact with high voltage lines, there will be an electrocution. How does that not go to that knowledge that injury will occur if there is contact with the high voltage lines?
The undisputed fact is that everybody at that work site thought that they could move the gable truss without Mr. Johnson contacting the power line. And that was the plan that was discussed according to the OSHA investigation that was done. And so Mr. Johnson knew the power lines were there. He appreciated the risk that they were there, but he truly believed that he could move the gable truss without contacting the power line. If Mr. Johnson had told Mr. Hickman, take that cable and toss it up over that power line, that would be consciously disregarding the injury would occur. He would know that that injury would occur. Even though he may not have intended that to happen, he would have known. But what happened here was an attempt to move the gable truss without contacting the power line. The fact that the plan didn't work was perhaps negligence, maybe negligence per se, maybe even gross negligence. But it does not rise to the level of the Merrick standard.
But isn't Mr. Bigelow's point that they're viewing the facts in the light most favorable to his client, there was no plan whatsoever? That Mr. Johnson, and I looked at his deposition testimony, he knew if the boom touched the high voltage power line, it would be bad, it would cause injury. And viewing the facts in the light most favorable to Mr. Bigelow's client, in response to that knowledge, Mr. Johnson took no precautions whatsoever, formulated no plan whatsoever, got in the boom truck, threw the cable at Mr. Hickman, and went about his way. How does that not satisfy the conscious disregard standard?
And that's a great question. I would submit that, and this goes into another argument that you've made, that I believe that is proper before the court, with regard to what evidence the court should consider on a motion for reconsideration. The recent Midtown Ventures case that this court decided just this past December, I think is very instructive on these attempts to create a record for purposes of an appeal. Now, if you view those facts in their light most favorable to them, I can see how you could get that result. However, those facts were not presented on summary judgment.
But Judge White allowed them to be considered on reconsideration, and so why do we come in and reverse that determination?
And I appreciate that. I would submit that it was an abuse of discretion to consider that evidence.
That's not our rule from Chicarello, is it?
The rule from Chicarello is that it is discretionary. The court has discretion to consider new evidence. But I would submit that it has to be evidence that was in the record, or evidence that was capable of coming from the record. What happened here, and I'd like to go through kind of the procedural history that's set forward.
I think I am. So before we even get to that, I'm struggling. You didn't file a notice of cross appeal on this, asking us to determine that Judge White abused his discretion in considering the material submitted with the motion for reconsideration strikes me as affirmative relief that you're seeking on appeal. And so help me understand why you're okay to make this argument without filing a notice of cross appeal.
Well, that's a great question, Justice Donald. I would submit that we filed an objection to that evidence. And because it was a motion for reconsideration, we get one chance to object, file a response, and then the motion is heard. Procedurally, we have no ability to take any depositions, to inquire of these witnesses. One of the witnesses had already made a statement.
Well, and I feel like we're getting to the merits, as opposed to, I understand all of what you're saying. You lost on your motion, and it wasn't your motion. I recognize there was other counsel. He denied their motion to strike the additional evidence. And so when you're now on appeal to us saying he erred, you shouldn't consider them, why don't you have to file a notice of cross appeal? Because that's affirmative relief that you're seeking.
Well, we filed an objection. It was not a motion to strike. We filed an objection. He did not rule on that objection. I would submit that because we objected, just like any objection at a trial, that is something that this court could review and determine if the objection was proper.
And you won the motion for reconsideration, which is why you're sitting over here instead of there, right?
We did.
So, I mean, the motion for reconsideration is, you won the war.
Right. So that would be the reason why we did not file a cross appeal. We felt like we won. We took issue with the fact that he considered the evidence. And I would submit, because procedurally, the way summary judgment works, that is your day to present your evidence. And the plaintiffs failed to come forward with all of that evidence until the motion to reconsider. And I just want to read from the Midtown decision. This court said, while a district court should consider new facts that bear on the correctness of the order when a party submits a motion to reconsider, this rule was not designed to allow parties to bypass timing rules or fail to conduct due diligence prior to the court's ruling. A motion for reconsideration is intended to protect parties against the court's error, but it is not intended to be a mechanism that encourages tactical brinkmanship or lack of diligence. And further from the Grumoville case, a motion for reconsideration is not a vehicle to undermine the trial court's decision on appeal by allowing newly asserted arguments and evidence placed into the record at the 11th hour to provide a basis for an appellate court to second-guess the trial court's initial decision. And I would submit that that would be an appropriate item, an issue that this court could consider, because we objected to that evidence, whether it was properly before the court on a motion for reconsideration, rather than when it should have been before the court, which was on a motion for summary judgment.
But aren't you then just asking us to engraft a hardline rule, which is no new affidavits, no new evidence? It's not a discretionary call on the part of the trial court. It's just, nope.
If it's not evidence that was developed in the record during the case, then I would say yes.
Didn't counsel, though, suggest that at least as to the depositions, that there had been excerpts provided before and the new evidence was just the complete transcripts of the depositions, or did I mishear him?
That was correct. There were additional excerpts from the deposition, but there were three additional declarations.
Right, but as for the depositions, that was already
record.
So you're not objecting to those?
No, and nothing in the depositions is really what they relied upon to make their arguments here and at the motion to reconsider.
And I guess my struggle with your argument, and this goes to Justice Brody's point, is, you know, when I was preparing for this argument, I went and looked at our motion for reconsideration decisions, or a number of them, and Midtown, I think we affirmed the district court's refusal to consider the additional evidence, but in other cases where the district court agreed to consider new evidence on reconsideration, we affirmed that because it is within the discretion of the district court. And so I'm struggling with, we have this long history of case law that says it's up to the district court. He made a decision, and how do we overrule that other than adopting a new rule?
Which you can do and have done many times when it comes to procedure, when it comes to the way the cases progress. The fact that their expert disclosure deadline had passed by the time judgment was entered in this case, without any expert disclosures, any supplementation, and then to come in on a motion of reconsideration and basically flood the record with information. I would also submit that if you consider the evidence from Mr. Sicklesteel, he doesn't make any statement about whether this was reckless. There is no declaration from Mr. Sicklesteel.
So my struggle for one is when I looked at the objection to the consideration of the additional evidence, I didn't see a reference to the expert disclosure deadline has passed and they haven't disclosed this individual as an expert. So was that, did I miss that in the objection, or was that raised somewhere else?
We did raise it at the oral argument on the motion to reconsider. Yeah.
Okay. And then I guess my other struggle is when I look at what they presented, it appears to be enough to create a genuine issue of material fact. And so if we do consider the additional evidence and we conclude Judge White didn't err, didn't abuse his discretion, what's your argument in light of that additional evidence for how they didn't meet the conscious disregard or at least create a genuine issue of material fact on that?
All right, I'll get to that right here. I would submit that the reason that even if you consider the evidence, which Judge White did, he considered the evidence, he looked at the information, and still came to the same conclusion that the standard had not been met. I would submit that there were no facts to suggest that Coulter Johnson consciously disregarded knowledge that injury would occur. And again, that was the standard that Judge White applied. That's not the Gomez standard, but that was the standard he applied.
Say it one more time, the exact language.
There were no facts to suggest that Coulter Johnson consciously disregarded knowledge that injury would occur, which is the standard for Merrick, standard for Barrett, not the Gomez standard. In fact, it was just the opposite. Coulter Johnson knew the power lines were there. He stated that he did not like them because they go zap, zap. He consciously regarded that risk or the condition of those lines and did his best to avoid contact.
And that's my struggle with your argument, because if we do consider the additional evidence they submitted, isn't there a genuine issue of material fact that he made no plan, he didn't abide by the guidelines for distance or, you know, determining the voltage of the power lines, that essentially he did nothing, if you view the evidence in light most favorable to their client, and he got in and he just started to work?
I would just admit that's not what happened. If you read his
And I understand that, but I'm focusing on what, if we consider what they put in, how did their evidence not create a genuine issue of material fact on that point where King says, there was no plan, I asked him to help me move the truss, he said no, you know, there's no evidence, in fact, I think Johnson concedes, I didn't look at the chart in the standards, I used a rule of thumb that I normally use, he didn't call the power company. I mean, they have all these facts, and it strikes me, I agree, it doesn't determine what actually happened, but it appears it creates a genuine issue of material fact on whether he did anything.
And I would just submit that you have to look at Coulter Johnson, because he's the one that determines whether or not this standard was met. It's what happened with regard to him.
It sounds like you're suggesting that the court should weigh the evidence and put all the weight on one witness.
Because that's what the standard suggests. It suggests that it's a conscious disregard of an individual. In this case, specifically Coulter Johnson.
Right, but where Coulter Johnson says, we made a plan, and King says, and he says, I made the plan with King, and King says, no, we didn't make any plan. And Coulter Johnson says, no, I admits he didn't call the power company and he didn't consult the chart and the standards. He used a rule of thumb that he normally uses, but essentially concedes, I didn't do these things according to the standards, even though I was aware of the standards and I'm certified and I've been recertified. Even if I look at his testimony, when I compare it to the others, the testimony of the others who were there, how does that not create a genuine issue of material fact?
That's a great question. And all I can say is that I judge why I looked at all of that and determined that there was no issue of fact. I think if you look at the cases, if you look at Barrett, if you look at Merrick, and the knowledge, collective knowledge that both of the employers had in those cases, I think it's also interesting in this case, you know, this case was not filed against King Builders, who was the direct employer of Mr. Hickman. This was a case that was specifically only filed against one individual and one employer. And so there is some indication here that at least there may have been a belief on the part of the plaintiff that they were unable to sue King Builders directly. King Builders was the employer who was reprimanded by OSHA. And so if there's fault here, it's everywhere.
Right, but doesn't that, if this goes to trial, doesn't that actually help your client? You can point at King Builders and say, no, we had a plan. In fact, King got on a phone call and walked away. He's the one who holds the bag here, not us.
Well, the interesting thing is in workers' compensation, because of the way the Maravilla case operates and these issues of whether or not there is a subrogation claim, whether or not we will be required to pay back the surety. Again, these complications that arise in cases that involve work accidents create those issues. But you're right. We can point the finger at King, but these are issues that I would submit need to be decided by judges and not juries. Judges need to make the decision whether or not this standard applies, not juries. These are not issues of fact. These are matters that the court should decide. And I would submit that the Gomez decision specifically sets the wrong standard. That was really what has created many of these cases, because it's a lesser standard. It's a recklessness standard rather than this conscious disregard of knowledge that injury will occur. I would like to just finish and focus a little bit on the Gomez decision.
I want to ask one question, though. You said something about your obligation to pay back the surety for King. If they prevail, they have to pay back, arguably, King, not... I mean, maybe your client has, maybe there's some kind of claim for indemnity or something, but the plaintiff ends up having to reimburse the surety. And then there becomes a dispute between the plaintiff and their own surety as to whether they get a subro interest because of the employer's own negligence in the case, right?
Well, so the way it would work is if the plaintiff recovers in this case and the employer is negligent, the surety, and at 1%, under Maravilla, it's 1% negligence on part of the employer. The surety is not allowed to recover the subrogation claim.
Right.
So all of the benefits that have been paid to Mr. Hickman are not subject to being paid back. So there's a huge windfall, because all of those benefits, the plaintiff does not have to pay that back if there's at least 1% fall on the part of the employer. And that's where these cases that spill over into workers' compensation create these problems. I was actually set for a trial that was scheduled to start next Monday in a case in front of Judge Thompson with a similar situation. And we were trying to put together jury instructions to explain to the jury how they were going to determine whether or not the workers' compensation exclusive remedy applied. And that's why I would submit that these are matters that should be decided by judges based on facts and make that determination. I became certified as a workers' compensation specialist probably 25 years ago. And we took a class over in Boise. The Industrial Commission put it on. It was a week-long class. We had to take a test after we were done to get certified. And the way that it was explained to me that the willful or unprovoked physical aggression exemption applied was only in cases where basically there were fights that would occur in the workplace. And that was the reason why there was the unprovoked physical aggression language, is because you didn't want to provide benefits to someone who provoked the fight. And that was really all that was discussed about this exception.
Yeah, but that ship sailed in Merrick.
That ship sailed in Merrick. But it is still knowledge of an injury and not what was said in Gomez. I would submit that the Supreme Court precedent, workers' compensation realm, is always subject to some interesting decisions. Specifically, the 20-year-old case of Robinson versus Bacon Hall, where another workers' compensation statute, 72-223, had been misapplied for decades. For 20 years, it was misapplied. And in the recent case from this court, Smith versus XL Fabrication, the court overruled Robinson and specifically stated this: the decision in Robinson was manifestly wrong, and overruling it is necessary to vindicate plain, obvious principles of law and remedy continued injustice. The dissent in Robinson more accurately reflects how the workers' compensation law should be interpreted. Plain language of Idaho Code Section 72-223 suggests that the Idaho legislature intended for certain entities, including owners or lessees of premises, to be immune from third-party tort liability. This court just wrote that decision a few months ago. I know a lot about that case because it was Judge Smith's case, and he was pretty upset that he got reversed on appeal because he felt like that decision, the Robinson case, was decided incorrect, and the court corrected that. I would submit that the court should do the same. I would submit that the court should mirror this language and say that the decision in Gomez was manifestly wrong, and overruling it is necessary to vindicate plain, obvious principles of law and remedy continued injustice. Further, dissent in Gomez more accurately reflects the workers' compensation law, how it should be interpreted. And finally, the plain language of Idaho Code 72-2093 suggests that the Idaho legislature intended for certain work accidents to be accepted from workers' compensation immunity. We would submit that Judge White applied a correct standard in evaluating this case. We would submit that he considered the evidence, and even considering the evidence, he determined that there were no issues of fact. That Coulter Johnson consciously regarded that there was a danger, and he consciously took precautions to avoid that. This was an unfortunate accident, but it is one that should stay specifically in the realm of workers' compensation and not be the subject of a suit. If there are no other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
17 minutes.
Sir?
Thank you, Justice Bevin and Justices. There's a number of points that I want to hit that were brought up by counsel, but first, I just want to say this is the first time I've heard any arguments from the respondents that Gomez should be overruled. That's not been included in any of the briefing, nor has it been argued on the level. Speaking to Gomez, counsel is correct. There is a different standard in effect today. And I believe that this court has already addressed that in the Fulford case. In a footnote in Fulford, the court stated that Gomez applies to all cases that arise prior to June 30th, 2020. After June 30th of 2020, there's a new standard according to the legislature that is in place. As far as Gomez, the argument that Gomez should not be retroactively applied, I would say that that is how jurisprudence works. Cases are always retroactively decided when it comes to an appeals level. In the specific case of Gomez, that occurred on April 21st of 2018, 2 years before it was decided, and also prior to the incident with Sam Hickman in 2019. As far as it was stated that all parties were in agreement that the plan could be carried out safely, that the crane could be used to move this truss, that is in dispute. The main dispute there is, at least from Sam Hickman's point of view, he never heard of a plan, he never had a conversation, there was no opportunity for him to even agree that it could be done safely, because he didn't know what it was.
Why does he have to agree to establish that Johnson consciously disregarded a known risk?
He doesn't. My point on that argument is simply that that is a contested fact.
Right, but my point is it's an immaterial fact whether your client agreed or not. If Johnson can otherwise establish there was a plan, I had a plan, right?
Right, and I think the point of Respondent's counsel arguing that was to show that, hey, there was a plan and it could be carried out. Based on looking at the evidence and the light most favorable timelines, that is disputed.
That there was any plan, right?
Correct.
Not just that your client wasn't aware.
Correct. That's the main crux of that issue, is that there was no plan. As far as the analogy that was used of Holger Johnson throwing your cable to Sam and telling him to throw it up to the power line, that's not a conscious disregard, that would be a willful action. For the exact reason I've already stated, there is no question that when you come into contact with an overhead power line, you will get electrocuted. And Holger Johnson knows that. He has actual knowledge of that. He's gone through this training that if he touches it, there will be injury. And so that would be a willful analysis, and we wouldn't even have to get into the conscious disregard. As far as the timing of evidence that was presented in the motion for reconsideration, we need to go back to when the summary judgment was first filed in June 2022. At that point, none of the discovery deadlines had run. Expert witness deadline had not run. We were months away from that. At the time that respondents filed their opening memorandum, the only issue that was brought up was whether or not they were statutory co-employees. They argued that they were, and because of that, the exclusivity rule applied. That is what we responded to in our objections to the motion for summary judgment. We agree that they most likely are statutory employees, but however, just as the exclusion or the exclusivity rule applies, so does the exception. That is what we were able to brief on. That is what we were able to argue. For the first time on the reply brief, was it mentioned that the 2020 amendment should in fact be retroactively applied. I never got a chance to brief that. There was never a chance for us to brief that issue. We did get addressed in oral arguments, and we did argue against that, but ultimately Judge White ruled in favor of the motion for summary judgment. What that is to say is this is very different from the cases cited in respondent's brief. Both Bruno Built and Sommerfield. In Bruno Built, what happened is the court granted a motion for summary judgment but didn't enter final judgment until 2 years later. It was after that 2 years that they filed their motion for reconsideration. What we're talking about here is within a week or two of that judgment coming out, we filed a motion for reconsideration. It was timely. It was within the 14 days as required by the Rules of Civil Procedure. So Bruno Built is on a very different fact pattern that did extend, and in that case it appeared that they purposely waited to extend the period that they could appeal. That doesn't happen in this case because we have 42 days to file an appeal. And so this wasn't a matter of us extending the ability to appeal. It was a matter of, hey, Judge, we weren't fully aware of what the issues were going to be decided. Do you think that there's additional arguments to be made? And also you should have the full facts. As far as an expert witness goes, let me finish up with Sommerfield. In Sommerfield, that's a medical malpractice case, and under Idaho law, it requires a plaintiff to present a prima facie case that includes an expert witness to establish the standard of care. In that case, their expert witness submitted three affidavits trying to establish that standard of care. The court, in its discretion, accepted the first two, but denied the third. In both Brunoville and Somerville, it's important to note that the trial court recognized it was a discretionary decision, acted on its discretion, and this court upheld it. That's all we're asking for this court to do as far as this case, is that Judge White did use his discretion, and that we should uphold that because there is no abuse of discretion. To that point, respondents have not argued an abuse of discretion in any of their briefing. There's the four factors for abuse of discretion. They're not mentioned in the respondent's briefing. They're not argued. As far as the expert witnesses go, we were working... Well, the record reflects that three depositions have been done. Richard Keene's deposition had not been done. There was an intent that that was going to be taken care of, but the motion for summary judgment came in. As far as Thomas Sicklesill goes, he's not presented as an expert at this point. Now, granted, at the time that summary judgment was granted, expert witness deadline had not run. It was still there. The deadline had not run. But up to this point, Sicklesill is not presented as an expert, and that's not the purpose of his declaration. He is a fact witness that establishes what the ASME standards are. He has knowledge of that. He makes no opinions. He makes no judgment about the recklessness. He simply says these are the standards. The reason that is important is that shows why this is so reckless and such a conscious disregard of the risks. Because Colter Johnson had the training. He knew how dangerous it was. He knew there were steps that he needed to take to minimize that, and he did none of them. And that is really the crux of what that is, why that is important. As far as whether there's a genuine issue of fact, a genuine issue of fact is a fact that the jury could find based on the possible testimony that could be presented. I believe looking at the totality of everything on the record, a jury could reasonably find that Colter Johnson consciously disregarded his training, consciously disregarded the risk, acted without any kind of a plan, or didn't implement any kind of a plan, even if he had briefly made one.
Can you address the argument from Respondents' Counsel that that's not a jury question at all? That has to be a legal question for a judge to make, and jury instructions can't be drafted. It just creates a mess. The judge is really the one to do that.
Yeah, well, I think Gomez addresses that at the very end. Gomez says that it's remanded, and the judge trial court must decide if there's a material fact, genuine material fact at issue for a jury to decide. And so the standard here is consciously disregarded the obvious, grave, or serious risk. That is the legal standard that we are saying applies. That is what a jury instruction can be based off of. Now, the facts that get us to that point need to be decided by the fact finder. The jury, the trial judge in a jury trial does not have that ability to establish what the facts are. Does that answer your question?
Well, I guess I'm not clear. So why wouldn't you just present a jury with the question on a special verdict form? You know, did the defendant engage in conduct that consciously disregarded knowledge of a serious risk of harm? Yes or no? I mean, isn't that the instruction or the special verdict form question?
That is exactly what I would submit if this goes to trial. Yes.
Okay. And your jury instruction is you have to here's what this means I guess you could even do it as a preliminary matter before you even asked about damages. You wouldn't have to, but I mean, I guess that would be a trial court consideration.
Right, and the argument that we're making is that Judge White in the lower court didn't even apply the standard, and that this is the standard that needs to be applied out of Gomez, and it's the jury who needs to decide what the facts are, and then they need to decide whether the facts rise to the level of an obvious, grave, or serious risk, or conscious disregard of an obvious, grave, or serious risk. So I agree 100% with you, Justice Burby, that is how it should be handled. In closing, unless there's further questions, I just want to end that from what is on the record and from my point of view, if this case does not rise to the level of conscious disregard of grave and obvious risk, I don't know what cases do. to be honest. There was no, again, looking like most favorable to my clients, there's no evidence or no indication to show that any plan was made, any plan was followed. There's plenty of evidence to show that Coulter Johnson knew of the risks, knew what he needed to do, and he did nothing. That is a conscious disregard. And so we ask that this court reverse the lower court and both the summary judgment and motion to reconsider. There's no further questions.
Very well. Thank you, counsel. With that, this matter is now under advisement. The court will enter decision in due course. We will now be in recess until Monday morning at 8:15, boys.
All rise.